It is May 31st, the final day of May. Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg on a Wednesday. Feels good. We're going to be closing out May pretty well. Later in the show, we'll be talking about social issues and marketing, specifically the recent news around Target pulling its Pride merchandise after threats to employees. We'll dig into commercialized LGBTQ plus pride and the responses from a politically divided nation with Cornell professor Catherine Sender.
And then after that, we talk to the Game Commission of Pennsylvania about outdoor safety and bears.
Mm-hmm.
But first, Cherry, let's dip our paw into the big old
honey
pot of news.
So good.
Chris Christie, boy, we remember that name, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Was governor of New Jersey for 8 years and is now expected to announce his candidacy for the Republican nomination for president in 2024. According to CNN, Christie will make this announcement at a town hall in New Hampshire next Tuesday. Chris Christie throwing his hat into the ring for president. Yet again, he did this in 2016, did not come very close to the White House. Taking another shot at it 8 years later.
Yeah, interesting, though. I mean, I remember covering, you know, being a reporter during the Christie years. Very interesting, very well-liked, pretty popular among Republicans when he was in office. He spoke plainly, and people liked that. He was a fighter. People liked that. His team says Christie will run a national race. They will focus on the, quote, exhausted majority. I'm sure we'll learn what that means, and that he'll be his authentic self, and that this campaign will be non-traditional. I'm looking forward to seeing the big announcements. We've been watching sort of like from our little perch here.
We've been waiting for
For this announcement and seeing how people roll it out and the response. So this is going to be a crowded Republican field.
It is surprisingly crowded.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me want to put on my politician's hat or try to look at this through the lens of a political advisor, because we can all read polls.
Uh-huh.
And they suggest that Donald Trump has a massive advantage over the field. Ron DeSantis is clearly in second behind Trump, who's way ahead, so far ahead of everyone, no one can see him. And so you have all these other people in the race, Chris Christie, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, Asa Hutchinson. And my question, of course, is why? What are you doing? What do you hope to achieve? And the best logic I can come up with is these people are thinking, well, someone's got to finish in third.
Yeah.
And if I finish in third, I'm in position to do something else in the future, be a cabinet secretary, maybe VP, maybe run in 2028. But I mean, if Chris Christie actually wins the nomination, it's the political upset of the century.
Yeah. But you never know. I mean, things have upset. I mean, nobody thought Donald Trump would win.
Sure, sure.
So you never know. Like,
Totally, upsets happen, but that was like a completely fractured field. Like, you know, Jeb Bush was like kind of polling ahead of people at the time, but it wasn't like these polls are like not very ambiguous. And one of the people running has already been president.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
yeah,
maybe these people really think they have a chance to win and I'm being naive. But
and there could
that's
be a
not
segment
what it feels
that
like to
wants
me.
Somebody different. I don't know. We'll see. We're going to watch it.
Okay. Let's go from, I guess, Trenton down the shore now, Cherry.
Yeah. Over Memorial Day weekend,
mm-hmm.
many people headed to the Jersey Shore. It's a tradition here in our region. And unfortunately, some beachgoers left a lasting impression, and it was not a good one. Ocean City Police say they responded to almost 1,000 incidents this Memorial Day, including underage drinking, vandalism, shoplifting. They even confiscated a gun. These number of incidents, 13% increase over the number last year. So the Shoretown City Council, they're holding an emergency meeting tomorrow afternoon. They're going to implement new rules. It looks like the beaches will now be closed at 8 p.m. for everybody. There'll also be a cutoff time for boardwalk bathrooms, and there will be a juvenile curfew that will be moved to 11 o'clock p.m. We also had the similar issues here in Philadelphia on Memorial Day. Couple hundred kids were on Penn's Landing Monday evening. Cars were left vandalized. Some fights were broken up. Now Philadelphia has, you know, we already had a curfew, but now that's 9:30 p.m. for kids under 13, a little later for other minors. But this is a teenage issue. You know, social media allows them to get together quickly. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I wonder how much of it is new and how much of it is old. You know, kids getting together in crowds is the plot of West Side Story, you know, so this is not
that
like a totally new thing. You do bring up an interesting point, I guess, about how social media has potentially amplified this. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a topic for another show, Jerry.
I think so. I think it's a deep dive. We need to talk about this because with, you know, click of a post, thousands can see it and show up in an hour. So how do we deal with that?
Right. I want to talk quickly about one of the most fascinating pieces of real estate in all of Philadelphia to me. It's called the Disney Hole. I will explain. This is a plot of land just down the street from us here between 8th and 9th Streets on Market. Really right in the heart of everything here in Center City, Philadelphia. And for years and years and years, in the beginning of the 20th century, it was the site of a Gimbel's department store, big flagship Gimbel's. Then they raised that in the 70s, and it sat vacant for a bit. And in the late 90s, Disney, this is how it gets its name, was supposed to build a mini theme park. Mini theme park never happened. Mm-hmm. Like, we can do the whole story later, but it didn't happen. It became a hole in the ground, and it became known as the Disney Hole. Eventually, they wanted to put a casino there in 2013. That didn't work because of opposition from the surrounding neighborhood, kind of similar to what's going on with the Sixers arena because they're like right across the street from each other. And so that didn't happen. And now today it's a big, ugly surface parking lot. But plot twist, Billy Penn has a story up right now by Mayor Rindy about how the parking lot may be sinking down into the hole, like into the Disney hole. I know this is a long story, but I find it completely fascinating. And so it's a little unclear if it's sinking. It definitely appears to be sinking. So questions of what's going to happen to this plot of land. Will it remain a parking lot? Is it literally sinking into the ground? All questions I have. You can go read that article at Billy Penn right now and learn more about it. I know I'm fascinated.
I was fascinated too. And this is so Philly. Yeah. You know, like, this is the most Philly parking lot ever, because there's like there's like these big cracks. Someone filled them with concrete so people wouldn't fall in the big cracks. The stand for the parking attendant, especially built to deal with deep slants, you know, in the parking lot. And then some birds are sort of sipping.
Is it funny?
Yes, I mean, it's so hilarious. They're sipping from the puddle or pond that has gathered. They're sipping serenely like it's a creek or something. Yeah. It's so Philly. I just love that story.
And it all is sort of, it's the confluence of all these things. It's the land itself, which looks, I think, is a bit unstable because there was a sinking problem back in the 70s. But that, plus the story of all this failed development, is sort of what has created this monstrosity today. I am curious what happens because people have always talked about the Disney Hole.
I had never heard of it. So
it's legendary within the scope of Center City because all of the area around it has had various developments over the years, and it has just sort of sat there inert. I mean, it's a parking lot, but that's sort of the lowest common denominator of use. So I hope it becomes something someday.
Definitely worth a read at BillyPenn.com. They always have cool Philly stories. So thinking about capturing your attention, like this Disney Hole, something that captured my attention, and shout out to my brother Vince, it captured his as
Shout out, Vince.
A Middletown groundhog has become a YouTube sensation.
This Middletown, Delaware, by
the Middletown,
way.
Delaware.
Because there is a Middletown, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Middletown, Delaware. His name is Chunk, the groundhog. Okay. And a Delaware farmer noticed this groundhog in his garden. And, you know, he was nibbling on his food. He wanted to capture him. But then when he saw him on the camera, he said, this thing is cute. He's going to be a star. And Chunk became a star. So let you hear what he sounds like.
Very provocative
and so
chewing sound
he
there.
He gobbles up like carrots and all sorts of vegetables. And he's so furry and adorable. And he like holds the little, I know I sound probably a little cuckoo for Cocoa Puff saying how much I love this little groundhog, but some of the YouTube videos have
alone.
Well over a million views. People go crazy for them. People have said on social media they use the views of Chunk as meditation to relax. They say, I watch a groundhog eating carrots. What is this hold these videos have over me? It is literally a groundhog eating produce, and I cannot look away. People can't look away from this, Avi.
Well, here's what I'll say about Chunk. The Groundhog Lane in Pennsylvania is very crowded because we got the groundhog on TV that tries to sell us scratch-off tickets. We got the groundhog in Punxsutawney that tells us whether it's winter or spring. But the lane in Delaware is wide open. We don't have a Delaware groundhog. And I think Chunk is doing us all a service by filling that lane admirably. My hat is off to you, Chunk the groundhog.
Yeah. And I know that farmer is making some money because every click, every view,
oh, yeah.
dollar bills.
Let's talk about dollar bills. And the housing market here in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And welcome in Aaron Moselle, housing and community development reporter for WHYY's Plan Philly. First of all, Aaron, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
We wanted to ask you about a story you did recently that is based on a report from the real estate brokerage Redfin that was looking at home values and home costs compared to rental costs in markets all over the country, including Philadelphia. So let's start there. What did the report find?
It found that Philadelphia was in a very select group of big cities around the country. There are four members. We have Cleveland, we have Detroit, we have Houston, and Philly. And what ties all these cities together is that at this point, it is cheaper to, you know, buy a house, a typical house, than to rent a typical apartment in these cities. Everywhere else in the country, it is far more expensive to buy a house. So it really is a standout thing for Philly.
You're talking about the per month cost, basically.
Right. We're talking about comparing the, you know, estimated median mortgage payment each month compared to the estimated median rent payment each month, correct?
And so let's dig into the reasons why. And I see the word stagnant home values. Can you talk about why this is a phenomenon in and around Philadelphia?
Yes. Yeah, so just for context, if you recall, during the height of the pandemic, everyone was buying houses, interest rates were really low, and home prices went wild because there was just a lot of fierce competition because of that. Things have sort of regulated and come down a little bit. But Philadelphia's prices, while they are still overvalued as we're talking, they never went as wildly high as other places. We don't know exactly why that is. I did talk to some housing experts. One of them said, you know, part of the reason why prices in Philly stay affordable is because it is still the poorest big city in the country. And so in terms of the demand for certain level of houses, we're talking about sort of high level, you know, high priced houses. It's just not there. So there's only so high that prices can go. It's not a complete answer, but it is offers some insight.
So I'm trying to understand if this is a good thing for a homeowner. I'm sure it's good that you're paying less per month. At the same time, one of the ways that you build equity is that the value of your home goes up and eventually you sell it and you cash out. So do we have a sense of whether homeowners right now in our region are in a strong position, a weak position? How do we contextualize this?
It sort of depends. If you're a homeowner and you're happy where you are and you bought your house, you know, during the pandemic and the interest rate was low, you're sitting pretty right now. If you're a homeowner that is really needing or wanting to get out of your house, you're in a bad place because particularly if you bought at a lower interest rate, because mortgage rates remain high. And so to go from a low mortgage rate to a high mortgage rate, most people don't want to do that. And so there's a lot of people that are just staying put. And because of that, there's not a lot of inventory for anyone who wants to buy, whether you're an existing homeowner or if you're a first-time home buyer that's renting now and wants to get in the market. So it's tough for both.
Interesting. Yeah. Mixed bag.
And so let's dig into this, because if you're like listening to this and you're renting, paying high rent, and you're like, oh, I want to get a house, there's other challenges as well to getting into a home if the inventory is so low.
Yeah, absolutely. So, because the inventory is low, and if you're looking in a neighborhood that people want to live in, let's say Point Breeze or more and more Germantown up in Northwest Philly, there's a lot of competition because there aren't that many houses. But also what this report doesn't really deal with is the enormous expense of the down payment. Mm. Most people in Philadelphia really can't afford that, even if the mortgage rate was lower, it's still a struggle. It's a big chunk of money for anyone who has recently bought a house or bought a house ever, you remember writing that check for that down payment.
Totally.
This report kind of assumes that people are putting 5% down. That's sort of the lowest you can put down, and most people who are buying kind of, they have to put down more because they don't have as, their credit scores aren't as good.
Well, thank you so much, Aaron, for joining us. That is Aaron Mozell.
Thank you.
Coming up, we are talking about LGBTQ plus pride, marketing, and the backlash. Stick with us on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Today is the last day of May. Tomorrow is June 1st. June is Pride Month. The celebrations begin bringing more visibility to issues concerning LGBTQ plus people. And corporations have increasingly tried to cash in on LGBTQ plus pride, with commercials showing same-sex couples or rainbow flag merchandise. Now, some see this as a growing sign of acceptance. Others call it rainbow washing.
And in case you didn't know, rainbow washing is the use of rainbow colors and logos to signal support for the LGBTQ plus community without actually taking any real action of support. And recent displays in Target stores of t-shirts, bathing suits, and coloring books have caused controversy. And there were so many incidents of anti-LGBTQ plus individuals tipping over displays and threatening employees that Target moved the racks to the back of the store and pulled some of the clothing.
Joining us now to talk more about Pride marketing and this anti-LGBTQ backlash and what companies should do is Catherine Sender, a professor of media and sexuality at Cornell University. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we want to hear your thoughts. Call us or email us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. So, Catherine, I want to throw this first question out to you. Before we talk about the stickiness of LGBTQ plus marketing, let's lay the foundation with some history. When did targeting the LGBTQ plus community become a thing that corporations leaned into?
So corporations became interested in LGBTQ consumers really as far back as the 1970s. And the products that were beginning to be targeted to readers of some of the gay magazines were the so-called sin products. So they were alcohol, cigarettes, disco music, a few movies and so on. Things that were perceived to be fairly robust in relation to not really suffering too much from a right-wing or conservative Christian backlash. And then in the 1990s, more and more companies began to be interested in LGBTQ consumers. And one of the ways that they got into the market was using event programming at Pride events. So they would have a booth or they would have a float. And it was a way to sort of fly under the radar of a more of greater awareness with more conservative people than would happen if they were in the gay press. And so it's really grown since then from event-based pride marketing to much more general campaigns that include merchandise, as you mentioned. It includes commercials, materials on their websites, and so on.
So why? What opportunity have companies seen over that period of time, and why have they started to seemingly lean harder into this type of marketing?
I think it's been very much to do with a real shift in approaches and attitudes towards LGBTQ consumers and inclusion. So what we're seeing now is particularly with younger generations, so Gen Zs and millennials, many, many more people are identifying as, it's somewhere under in that spectrum of, you know, queer, non-binary, transgender. But also that these generations really value progress and inclusivity. So even if you're not, 25-year-old LGBTQ person, when you see an ad that is inclusive, you're much more likely to think of the company as being progressive and inclusive. And that's very much a value that younger consumers particularly uphold.
And I want to talk about, just expand that discussion a little bit, because I feel like marketing is different from taking it a step further and taking a stand on social issues related to the LGBTQ plus community. Can you explain the difference between just showing a rainbow flag or signaling that you're inclusive and taking it a step farther?
Yes, that's a really great point. I mean, so companies are very sensitive to being accused of rainbow washing, you know, which is when you just, you know, slap a rainbow on your website for the month of June and, you know, call it a day. And because of social media, LGBTQ consumers and allies are very attentive to this and will circulate accusations of rainbow washing extremely quickly. So companies really need to make sure that they have their houses in order when they're going to be approaching LGBTQ consumers. And so one of the ways is to, firstly, not just do it in June. To keep a consistent campaign going throughout the whole year. Another is to include LGBTQ people in the production of marketing campaigns. But they're much more likely to make a convincing and authentic appeal. But as you mentioned, one of the really powerful things that they can do is to actually partner with one of the many nonprofit organizations that are set up to support LGBTQ people. So we have companies that help with funding for GLSEN, the Gay and Lesbian Education Network, for GLAAD, the media watchdog, for trans and queer youth who are homeless, and so on. So we've really seen a big shift in signaling a level of commitment to supporting LGBTQ causes and inclusivity across the board.
I want to bring in a caller who I believe has a comment related to all of this, but I also want to remind folks first that if you want to contribute to the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499, or you can email studio2@whyy.org. Adam is on line one and wants to add a little to the conversation right now. Adam, welcome to Studio 2. What's your comment?
Hey, thank you for bringing me on. I just wanted to make a comment that rainbow washing is certainly a serious issue, but it's also, you know, really important to point out that a lot of these companies that participate in marketing toward LGBT communities that make money off of images of LGBT likenesses, you know, they also behind, you know, our backs just donate to really conservative issues that not only don't help us, but actively hurt us, legislatively speaking. So it's, you know, not only the fact that they're not doing things internally, but sometimes they're at the same time as signaling to us that they're helping or that they're open, they actively oppose our interests. And that's something that a lot of the LGBT plus individuals are really tired of.
So the hypocrisy there. Professor Catherine Sender, can you comment on that? Are people aware of potential hypocrisy here with this type of marketing?
Yes, I think Adam makes a really great point. Thank you for that. I mean, and that's another way in which companies have to be very careful about whether they're not just talking out of two sides of their mouths. You know, so there have been companies who have been called out on social media for, on the one hand, giving money to the gay community, but on the other hand, giving money to usually Republican candidates who may be running for office. And I think what we're seeing here is a conflict of interest in terms of their economic bottom line, because on the one hand, they want access to gay consumers and they want LGBTQ people's money. But they also, many of the conservative people that they support often have extremely generous tax breaks for these companies. And so on the one hand, they want the profits from selling stuff, but on the other hand, they don't want to pay tax on it. And a sort of further loop of that is not just that they're supporting these conservative candidates who may get in office and give them tax breaks, but often many of those taxes are then not going to the LGBTQ communities in those areas.
Yeah, I think about the issue with Target that we kind of referenced in the introduction. And I want you to kind of comment on that, because on one hand, you have organizations or corporations that want to be supportive, but when they show open support, they get backlash from some communities. And then if they take a step back, that can cause even more backlash from the community that they initially tried to support. Can you talk about this tension and conflict that I think a lot of corporations may be feeling, or folks who are looking in may be feeling and having concern about whether to step out in support, or they're trying to make decisions on what to do? Can you talk about that sort of tension there?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think my basic advice is that if you are planning an LGBTQ marketing campaign, to know that there may be some pushback, and to put as many protections as you can in, particularly around your employees, so that people are prepared and protected from some of the more aggressive activities that we've been seeing more recently. I mean, I think what's the degree of violence that's happened this year particularly, I think, is really taking a lot of us by surprise. And so with Target, I know they've had some criticisms for sort of pulling back on their marketing and merchandise campaign. But I feel like they're in a really tricky spot, because they're protecting their employees, and I think that is the absolute first thing that they should be doing, because nobody who's working in these stores should be expected to deal with hostility and harassment from anybody. So I think that's been the real difference, which is, boycotts have happened, forever. I mean, and I think boycotts are a fine way of, making a political decision. I don't give money to companies that I don't like their politics. And over the years, what's been interesting, though, is that initially companies were very worried about right-wing and religious conservative boycotts back in the 80s and the 90s. But what's happened really in the last 20 years is a pivot where companies are much more concerned about LGBTQ people and our allies boycotting companies that they now feel they have much more to lose when it goes in that direction.
I want to reintroduce our guest, who is Catherine Sender, professor of media and sexuality at Cornell University. And I wanted to bring in a clip. This is a gentleman at a Target store, because you referenced this idea that there can be irate people threatening employees at stores that get targeted by right-wing groups. This is a gentleman at one of these Target stores talking about a pride display. Let's play that clip.
In November, do we get a veterans display that says proud to be a veteran? No, we do not. Yeah, I'm.
I don't need to scream. I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry. I just talk loud.
Yeah.
I hope that corporate is watching this.
I just need to lower
because
it.
This is no problem with the pride section. Take the kids out of it. That's what you have to do. Get rid of the kid that doesn't belong in here. You cater to 0.1%, and 99% of us buy this in this store, but that's coming to an end.
Catherine, I feel like you made mention of the idea that maybe what's going on with Target is a little different than what we've seen before. Why? Do you get a sense of maybe what's shifting under the surface here and how that augurs for the future?
Well, I think what we're seeing in getting enacted in some of these stores is part of at least two broader trends. One is that LGBTQ issues are becoming a very contested issue in terms of legislation, and we've seen many state and local bills that are trying to really curtail the visibility of LGBTQ people in schools, in libraries, in drag bars. And so on the one hand, there's a political LGBTQ issues are being seen as a kind of political wedge issue and are being mobilized by certain parts of the Republican Party in order to, whip up popularity for their party, basically. And we're also seeing a much greater level of incivility in public discourse. So violence and harassment online through social media, but also increasingly in person. And we've seen two really horrendous shootings in gay clubs in the last few years. And so, you know, unfortunately, and I'm finding this very difficult to deal with, and not just around LGBTQ issues, but the idea that if you have a resistance to a certain idea or group of people, now some people think that it's okay to actually target them with harassment and violence.
Yeah, and I want to bring in a comment from Loretta, who says, now people are attacking Kohl's for some of the clothing they've been displaying, and I've been on Facebook trying to fight back. It's so upsetting. I think these companies are doing more than just cashing in. It is about their bottom line. And if you want to comment like Loretta did, you could call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. And Catherine, I want to ask about the public sentiment, because there's polls out there. And I know that there's a difference between the way people feel about LGBTQ plus people rights and trans visibility. Can you talk about what the way people feel just about the LGBTQ community generally in the United States?
Well, I think it's incredibly complex. And I think some of some polls are better than others. And so, but the most respectable and reputable ones I've seen recently, I mean, on the one hand, I think there is in general a much greater support for things like gay marriage and LGBTQ rights in general. I think the really contested area right now is around trans visibility and trans rights. And so I think that that's where people have a lot of actually quite contradictory feelings about this. So I was looking at a report from the Kaiser Foundation recently. So, you know, people are in general, the majority of people are in support of people being able to choose their own gender identity. But when the really contested issues seem to be around athletics and whether or not trans women can participate in female sports. And around youth, and so the issue of healthcare and whether young trans people should get access to particularly gender affirming hormones. So, I think it's you know, when you actually get down into the weeds of it, it's really a lot of it is quite contradictory. But those seem to be the most the most significant kind of findings from some of these reports.
And quick follow-up to you, because I look back at old Gallup polls, and from the mid-90s, you had only 27% of Americans were okay with gay marriage. Fast forward to today, it's more above 70%. Mm-hmm. And so I just wonder if over time, those types of attitudes would change.
I really hope so. I mean, we're seeing an interesting parallel in media representations of gay people versus trans people. And so many of the ways in which gay and lesbian people were represented, you know, 20 or 30 years ago as victims or villains, now trans people are very often represented still in that way. And so, I mean, I would like to think that kind of progress happens and that, you know, that the issue around contested trans visibility will become less and less intense over the next decade or two. But with everything that's going on right now, I'm not quite sure whether we can be that optimistic. I would like to think we can.
Speaking of trans visibility, one of our listeners, Jack, wanted us to talk about what happened with Bud Light. Bud Light partnered with an influencer, and then people boycotted the beer just because there was a trans person involved in this ad campaign. And I wanted to ask you a question based off of that. I was looking into some survey data that suggested that the average Bud Light drinker is more conservative. But if you look at other beers like Stella Artois, for instance, the drinkers are more liberal. Both of those brands are owned by the same people. I think it's InBev, Anheuser-Busch. And so one of my questions, based on what happened with Bud Light, is will we see companies basically align with Pride on one of their brands and then ignore Pride with another brand as a way to try to sort of avoid controversy but still move product?
Well, that's a really interesting thing. I mean, I think that may easily be happening. I mean, one of the things to say about Bud Light is that they've been advertising in gay media since the 1990s. Mm. So they were actually one of the earliest people that came in. And I think that the fiasco with Dylan Mulvaney was very, very badly thought through. I mean, one of the issues is we always see companies when they're losing market share, they think, oh, let's advertise to the gays. They've got money. And I think that you know, that they try to make a splash by pairing with Mulvaney on their Bud Light, you know, with a sort of specific can that they made for her. And then when they got backlash, and, you know, I'm not surprised that they got backlash, just given how things are at the moment, then they pulled it and, you know, just sort of basically apologized and put all of their senior marketing people on you know, suspended leave. So I think that they should have thought that through better and not just throw the marketing people under the bus when they got, you know, a lot of pushback on that.
That's a good point. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you're thinking through this, you know, if you're thinking, you want to say, I'm a corporate ally, right? How do you think through, you know, your decision? Like, do I partner with an influencer? Like, how do you think through the steps of doing this in a way when you try to take in who your brand appeals to? What are some of the steps?
Well, I think the key thing is including LGBTQ marketing experts in their campaigns so that they can make sure that they have their own house in order in terms of making these appeals, that that they have employee groups and representatives from those groups having input into these kinds of campaigns. And I think also to expect pushback and to know how to address it. I mean, it was interesting seeing the Miller Lite, the criticism of Miller Lite around, you know, the kind of feminist, you know, is this now the feminist beer? And Miller, I think, had the right response, which was, you know, come on, people, this is a joke. You know, this is funny. This isn't supposed to be a serious thing. And so I think, you know, to have marketing experts who are used to dealing with, you know, what can often be quite contested terrain involved in the process will really is probably the most important thing.
Really interesting question here from listener Hannah. Is this a uniquely American reaction to LGBTQ plus pride merch, or do we see global trends in terms of backlash as well? And I'm sorry if I'm venturing too far afield here, Catherine, but can you comment on that?
Oh, I think that's a really great question. I wish I had a better sense of it. Unfortunately, if I said anything, it wouldn't be based
fair.
On any kind of knowledge.
And I really appreciate that.
I don't currently do international research. Yeah.
I appreciate that because some people just try to pretend like they know. I'll follow up with my own question here. I wanted to flip the political lens a little bit and talk about Goya, which is a food brand. Mm-hmm. You'll recall the CEO went to the White House in 2020, praised then-President Donald Trump. There was a backlash and a backlash to the backlash. I was reading a study recently by a trio of scholars, one of them from Cornell, actually. They study what happened during this Goya controversy, and they found that Goya's sales actually went up in the near term and then stabilized pretty quickly, which got me thinking, do these boycotts or bicots even work? Like do these have any long-term effect on these companies?
Well, I think in terms of, you know, sales, I would be surprised. I mean, I know Bud Light had a dip in sales for a couple of weeks, but eventually people who like Bud Light are going to go back and drink that beer. You know, they'll say, "Well, I did that, and now I'm going to go back and drink beer." But I think there's a bigger question which you were asking, which is, does the kind of visibility and notoriety of this of these kind of very public struggles, do they end up actually bringing more consumers to the brand because the brand becomes, you know, whether you like their stance or not, the brand becomes much more visible against their competitors. And so those Goya statistics, I think, are really interesting.
And we have about less than a minute, and we have an email from EM who references the Stonewall movie. They shared their quote, "Gay money is still money." And I want to just talk about, as we wrap up, should corporations get involved in this right now, in this fight for LGBTQ plus rights? Or do you think all these controversies is going to cause people to want to turn away? And we only have about 20 seconds for you to answer that question.
I mean, I think they are. I think they're signaling not just visibility for LGBTQ consumers, but also the really committed ones that were also taking a political stand, for instance, like Disney in Florida.
Thank you so much. That is Catherine Sender, professor of media and sexuality at Cornell University. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us and helping us break this all down on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, what to do if you meet a bear in the woods. We've got a bear biologist standing by on Studio 2 after this quick break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. I love nature. And if you're like me, are you planning to get out into the Pennsylvania wilds this summer? Take a mountain hike or dip in a lake? Well, there is a chance you could see a black bear. You probably know that Pennsylvania has a healthy population of black bears. They live in most parts of the state, except for down here in the southeast. We don't see many in Philly.
But you may have seen recently that a bear attacked two small children playing in their driveway in Luzerne County. Fortunately, the kids are okay, but the black bear was euthanized. So today, as more of us take to the woods this summer, we thought we would talk about black bears and learn more about them.
And what to do if you encounter one. Emily Carollo is a black bear biologist for the Pennsylvania Game Commission. Emily, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Emily, first I got to ask, how many black bears are there in Pennsylvania? And are the population trends up, down, stable?
Yeah, that's a great question. So right now in Pennsylvania, we're estimated to have a little over 15,000 bears. In the last few years, we have seen a bit of a decrease. Now, that's kind of slightly intentional for the number of years leading up to 2019 before we introduced a couple of new seasons. We were hovering around anywhere from 18,000 to 20,000 bears. And so as a manager, what we normally manage for is kind of two carrying capacities. And one is a biological carrying capacity, which basically means how many bears can the landscape support with food, shelter, water, et cetera. And then there's a social carrying capacity. So how many bears can an area tolerate? And obviously throughout Pennsylvania, this varies, right? You know, we don't want bears in Philadelphia, obviously. You know, that's not a place we want bears. Mm-hmm. But in some places in Pennsylvania, like the north central part of the state, where the vast majority of lands are public lands, we typically can have a pretty large bear population with not as much conflict because there's not as many people. So we kind of introduced these new seasons to get a little bit better handle on how large our bear population was growing, especially in relation to that social carrying capacity, and make sure that the bear population is a little bit more stable in the long run.
So the bears have been in hibernation. Can you describe the typical cycle of when they go kind of dormant or quiet and come back out into the public, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. And hibernation is actually a really cool process for bears, because basically black bears range throughout North America. I mean, we're talking all the way from the Everglades in Florida, all the way up to northern Maine and into a good chunk of Canada, kind of the southern half of Canada. And so if you think about the really wide range of environments that black bears live in, hibernation kind of varies on that scale. So here in Pennsylvania specifically, normally we see black bears hibernate roughly from like mid-November to beginning of April, but that varies a little bit based on age and sex. So if there's a female that's pregnant in the fall, They are the earliest bears to den, and there you have their cubs. They're actually all born roughly around early January to mid-January. And then those females with cubs will leave the dens the latest, which is typically around beginning of April. Now, for males, they might not actually start denning until early January or late December, and they might come out as early as, you know, early March, mid-March. Now, typically when they come out of hibernation, even in those earlier circumstances with males, they kind of get up, stretch their legs, wander around, find a little bit of food, and lay back down when kind of weather gets a little bit bad again. Because we all know March, some days it's absolutely beautiful, and some days it's like, where did all this snow come from?
Just like us, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So we get out in the woods, and then we go back to bed, right? So yeah. Bears will kind of do the same thing, but with very young cubs, females will typically wait right around till that beginning of April timeframe.
So I want to emphasize and get your amen here. Bear attacks, confrontations between humans and bears, very rare, right?
Yes, okay. Absolutely very rare.
When they do happen, do we tend to know why?
Yeah, so we actually have done, not Pennsylvania specifically, but black bear biologists and managers have done a lot of research on, you know, specifically these really more concerning black bear interactions. And I'm talking about, you know, home break-ins where bears are breaking into homes and getting into refrigerators, or actual physical contact between bears and humans. And for the most part, you know, we basically break down our black bear attacks into two categories, and that's more of a defensive kind of contact, human contact, and then a predatory kind of human contact. Now, black bears can be predatory, but it is an incredibly rare event. There was actually this really wonderful paper done by a gentleman named Stephen Herrera, who also has a book about bear attacks, not just about black bears, but grizzlies as well, and describes a lot of the events that he researched. This particular paper looked at documented events of human fatalities by black bears from 1900 until 2009. And there was a documented, I think it was 63 events, right? So we're talking about, and this is throughout the entire United States and parts of Canada, I believe. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands of black bear and hundreds of millions of people. And so that kind of puts it into scale how very infrequent these kinds of major contacts are. So when we're talking about predatory events, they're even more rare, but it can happen. And so those are pretty straightforward, right? Unfortunately, the bears in those circumstances are going after people in a predatory kind of sense.
Yeah.
But most of these contacts actually occur because a black bear is unfortunately cornered in a situation where it doesn't have an easy escape route. So the vast majority of encounters with black bears end up with the person easily being able to scare a black bear away.
Yeah.
But if you corner a black bear by accident that's breaking into your garbage in your garage, and the black bear has to go through you to go out, it's probably going to run over you and actually end up leaving the situation that way. And most of those interactions end up being where a black bear literally just swipes to make some space, and the person gets scratched, and the bear leaves. So it kind of gives a little bit more information on kind of the defensive side.
And I want to jump in here, first of all, because I just saw a cocaine bear. So I'm glad to know that that is not real. That couldn't really happen.
No, that bear actually died in about 40 minutes, by the way, as a side note.
So, like, I want to just give people practical tools. If a bear, a black bear, sort of wanders onto your property, and you are in a confrontation with it, or you're close to it, what do you do?
That's a really great question, and I always try and go over this with any outreach talks I have. And the way that I kind of describe it to people is you have basically three scenarios, and most of this is, you know, based on going a hike in the woods, but it easily works for bears in your yard too. And first and foremost, if we're talking about bears in your yards, there's an easy way to prevent black bears from coming into your yard and possibly creating a close encounter, and that is to contain anything that might attract a bear to your yard. So keeping your garbage stored and locked away, keeping bird feeders down during times when bears are active, making sure there's no pet food left outside for bears to find. I mean, the list goes on. But say you encounter a bear, I break it down into three scenarios. You encounter a bear, you see the bear does not see you. easiest thing to do is basically just remove yourself from the situation. Say you're walking down a hiking trail, you see the bear, bear's kind of just walking across the path, back down the trail, 10, 15 minutes, wait it out a little bit. And then if you want to continue on that direction, you're more than welcome to. Just make sure as you get close to that area, you're nice and loud. If a bear hears you coming, they're going to keep moving on. And especially in those situations where bears have more than enough space to remove themselves, they're going to remove themselves from the situation. Now you get to the second part where you're still a pretty good distance from the bear, but you see the bear and the bear sees you. At that point, you want to start talking to the bear, probably in a pretty loud voice so it knows you're human. You might want to put your hands above your head or clap, basically to just encourage the bear to keep moving away in the direction of whatever it was doing.
And then quickly
the third one, because we only have 10 seconds.
No problem. Long story short, if you do have a close encounter with a black bear that's super close, be extra loud, make yourself really big, and if a black bear ever actually attacks you, fight back. And I'll plug in real quick, Bearwise.org is a wonderful resource to learn all about preventing human-black bear conflict.
Beautiful.
Perfect.
Bearwise.org. That's Emily Carollo, bear biologist at the Pennsylvania Game Commission. We are wrapping up Studio 2 for today. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Al Banks from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks so much for joining us today.